Welcome to Kolisha, the podcast of heterodox Jewish women. This is a bit different from the last few episodes here, in that this is a purely verbal essay. I'm going to be talking today about the queering of consent and what's missing from a lot of the discussions of the WPATH files. I think it's a mistake to focus excessively on the problem that children lack capacity to consent to trans medicalization. The problem's much more serious than that. The problem is that the very concept of medical care and the very concept of consent, these two concepts have been queered, and that confusion over the meaning of these has led to abuse. Enjoy. By now, most people listening to this have probably been exposed to the horrors of the WPATH files. I'm not going to go through any of that today. Frankly, not very much in those files surprised me. Last May, I listened in horror to some of the episodes of the Transparency podcast after the Gender Dysphoria Alliance went undercover at the National Transgender Health Summit. And I heard, for example, discussions there about how to extract consent from a nonverbal autistic child who was gender incongruent to justify putting that child on puberty blockers. But perhaps because this little boy is putting on his sister's dresses, that's his way of communicating his female gender identity, even though he can't talk. So that can count as consent, this sort of thing, which is just absolutely horrifying. And I remember thinking, how do I rationalize how sensible, intelligent, possibly moral human beings can behave this way, which to me is just absolutely outrageous. So trying to understand the mindset of people who make these arguments to me is extremely important, because if you don't understand what's making people think this way and where their thinking is going wrong, you can't argue back. And it's the well-meaning people who make those sorts of excuses and arguments that are the main obstacle to real political progress in terms of preventing these sorts of horrendous, what I view as human rights abuses that are going on. Now, looking at what was actually revealed in the WPATH files, what I've seen is nothing surprising. It's all the same stuff that was revealed last year, just more of it, and hopefully now people will pay attention. But there is something that I think has been missing from the analyses that I've seen of the WPATH files. And that is, a lot of people express utter horror at the complete failure of basic competence in terms of dealing with informed consent, that informed consent has just not been happening. But what I don't see is an attempt to really understand or analyze or work out how it is that people did that. Why it is that people so ignored what we would consider to be normal informed consent, and they found that to be normal. So what I want to do today is to show you that what's happened here is actually just another example of queer theory. There has been a queering of consent, and if you understand it in terms of queer theory, then suddenly it all makes sense and you understand the apparent ridiculous contradictions and how illogical the arguments are that you're getting from the other side, and also can understand why those arguments make sense to them. Because once you're in a queer theory mindset, things make sense from that point of view. And then the challenge is how to pull them out. Now, when I talk about queer theory, I'm talking about the queering of language, so that language becomes unclear in its meaning, and then words can have more than one meaning at once. Now, queer theory can mean a lot of things, but I'm specifically focusing on this aspect, which involves the queering of language, so the things become deliberately opaque, and an attitude which treats such opacity of language as a virtue rather than as something we need to avoid. Now, the problem with language that's unclear in meaning is that when words can mean more than one thing at once, what happens is you can make an argument, and you start at the beginning of your argument with propositions about some particular category of things based on one meaning of a word. And then further down the argument, you change the meaning of the word, but you don't let anyone know you've done that. And that's okay because you're querying language, so everything's fuzzy. And then you reach a conclusion at the end, which apparently is solid. So you have a solid beginning, you queer the word along the middle, and then you have a solid result at the end, and you claim that what you've done is queer theory. But what you've really done is a kind of magic trick. It's a sleight of hand to get an actual constructive ending that's a lie. Now, this is actually what propagandists do all the time. Queer theory is a fantastic tool for propagandists and for people who want to rationalize something being true, which they want to be true, but which isn't true. And people also might not even be doing this consciously. They can do it unconsciously. So just to illustrate this, here's an example of how language queering can be used. Let's take the classic example of the word woman and how that gets queered. So we initially will have a meaning in our heads of the word woman. And we all know when we imagine a woman, we mean adult human female. Even the people who say that trans women are women, when they say the word woman, they have in their heads, they imagine an adult human female, which is why trans women want to look like women. So here's the argument. We know that women are particularly vulnerable to violence because they're physically weaker than men and they need more protection. We feel kind of caring and protective for women. Then you make the claim trans women are women. When you do that, you've queered the word woman, you've fuzzed the word woman. So now the word woman includes all sorts of people who just say that they're women, but they aren't actually women. So women means this fuzzy group now. And then you had this proposition you started with, remember, which was that women are vulnerable and weak and need protection. But you've got trans women now in the category woman. So now you can conclude that trans women are vulnerable and they need protection because they're women. And we know that women, you know, they're weak. Except, of course, these women, in quotes, are not actually the same as the women we started with. But never mind that. You end up with a conclusion that trans women need to be treated with kid gloves. And therefore, you can't put trans women in women's prisons, even if they have an intact penis and they just raped someone. Because you've got this image in your head of a woman, and you're attaching that word to this male person, and then you feel empathy towards that person because you've attached this word that has connotations that are, of course, of a different category of people from the one that you're now talking about. And you have an emotional response to the word based on the meaning you started with. So this is how the sleight of hand works that people do using queer theory and how you end up getting a non sequitur to appear as if it's logical. It's extremely manipulative. I grew up with two mathematician parents, so this sort of thing doesn't really get past me. But a lot of people just can't work out what's going on, and so they'll fall for it. Now, sometimes people are doing this on purpose. I think certainly in some cases with respect to the trans women in women's prisons, I think it really has been used deliberately. There have been some pretty unsavory characters who have pushed this idea. But sometimes it's unconscious. It's just sloppy thinking. And sloppy thinking can lead you to very, very sloppy conclusions. So what's now behind this whole mess with the lack of informed consent? And it's really not difficult to demonstrate the absolute dog's breakfast of consent. There really is no real informed consent happening. Frankly, I don't even think that there's informed consent happening with adults in the trans healthcare system at the moment, let alone for kids. Because you're not being given accurate information from doctors. And if doctors aren't being honest with you about a procedure that you're offered, even if you have capacity to consent, in normal cases, your consent isn't informed, it's misinformed. There's no informed consent going on here. And yet somehow the people involved in WPATH are still calling this informed consent. How is this happening? Now, my proposition here is that what they're doing is the people at WPATH are viewing what's happening as informed consent because they've queered the concept of consent in the same way that trans activists have queered the word woman. I'm going to show you how that's what's exactly happened. The thing to understand here about the word consent, informed consent, firstly, is that normally when it comes to regular medically necessary healthcare, we have a policy that doctors won't do any procedure on you, even if it's medically necessary, without first getting informed consent from you, because there's a need to respect patients. And this is a legacy, for example, of the abuses of the past, for example, the experiments done by the Nazis or the Tuskegee experiments that happened to black men in America. There's this awareness that nobody should be having any medical procedures done to them unless they know what's going on. And it's important that doctors are honest, because there's a potential for abuse of people. And certainly nobody should be forced to have medical procedures that they don't want. And this basic idea of bodily autonomy and respect for human rights. So that's the one thing going on with consent. But there's another side to this. And that is that there are exceptions that can be made to the rules of informed consent. Informed consent is almost always needed from the patient that is being treated. But sometimes you can't get informed consent from a patient because they lack capacity. But that doesn't mean that they won't get treated. So, for example, if somebody comes into hospital and they're either a child or they've got Alzheimer's or dementia or just very, very low intelligence so that they can't understand what's going on and they have appendicitis, you don't just let them die. You don't say we're not going to remove your appendix because you can't consent. They have a right to medical treatment. And what you do is you use the best interest principle. You get some other person who can be trusted to make the decision on behalf of the person who lacks capacity. And if you look in the show notes, I've got some links there to the policies of various medical associations on how that takes place. It's pretty standard that we do that. The idea here is that if they could understand what was going on themselves, they would consent. And you believe it's in their interest to have the appendix taken out, and therefore you're able to consent on their behalf. And in fact, if someone's psychotic, you will sometimes do this sort of surgery even over their objections because they're deemed to be insane, and therefore they lack capacity. Their refusal isn't valued because they're not of sound mind. So we have this principle that somebody who doesn't have capacity does not need to give consent themselves. Somebody else does it on their behalf. And this other person is meant to have a responsibility to be looking after the patient's best interests. And if that person gives consent and it turns out they didn't have the best interest of the patient in mind, then that's abuse. In fact, it could be criminal. So, for example, parents will give consent for children to have all sorts of things done. But if those parents go and take their daughter to Somalia or whatever to get their genitals mutilated, then they get prosecuted because they've engaged in action which is not in the best interests of the child. It's abuse. So we have these first normal informed consent when you are agreeing to get medically necessary care done for you. And you have to give consent. You have a right to say no. Secondly, the person who lacks capacity, who can be treated anyway, somebody else gives consent on their behalf. And then there's a third aspect of informed consent, and that relates to medical procedures that are not medically necessary. Elective surgeries, cosmetic, aesthetic surgeries, plastic surgery, getting a boob job, getting a nose job, that sort of thing. And there are a different set of ethical guidelines for those things, and they vary by country, but there's quite a lot of consistency across modern Western countries, in the same way that there's quite a lot of consistency with respect to this idea of duty of care when you give consent on behalf of a dependent. So if you look at countries like the USA, the UK, Australia, etc., with respect to aesthetic surgeries, there is a professional standard that for these sorts of procedures, there has to be informed consent. And that informed consent must come from the patient themselves. It can't be given by somebody else for you. So if you're a child, if you're somebody who's mentally ill, if you're not capable of giving consent yourself, you can't go and get a boob job. And in fact, you can see warnings in the literature about the dangers of giving aesthetic surgery to people who are mentally unwell, that it's known that these sorts of procedures can actually make mental illnesses worse. And you're meant to do very, very careful gatekeeping and screening to make sure your patients can give consent. And the gatekeeping has to be much more stringent than it would be for medically necessary care, where a doctor can, in a paternalistic way, know that this is in the patient's interest, so they're not worried about the patient regretting afterwards having had, say, silicone breast implants, if it turns out that at the time they were psychotic. You're not going to regret getting your appendix taken out, even if you were mentally unwell at the time. And then there's also this other category of things that are non-medical, such as tattoos, which kind of fall outside the system. Because it's outside of the medical system, it doesn't really come into the whole informed consent discussion in the same way. It falls more in the same category as things like consent to sex and what age you're able to drink or drive and that kind of thing. But now, just think about gender medicine. Where does that fall? Is gender medicine the same sort of medical treatment as removing your appendix or like giving you insulin when you have diabetes? Or is it more like getting a boob job? And this matters a lot because it affects how we deal with consent. Because if it's treated like a ruptured appendix, then the degree of consent required is less. You can, for example, have parents consent on behalf of children. You can have doctors decide that a mentally ill person needs to have these procedures done. Whereas if it's an aesthetic procedure like a boob job, then only a person who is highly mentally together will be allowed to have these procedures done. So the question is, where does gender affirmative care fall? What category is it in? Now, before we answer that, there's also going to be this gray area in between aesthetic surgery and medically necessary surgery. There are some kinds of aesthetic surgeries that might be viewed as medically necessary. And this is not just some fantasy. For example, if somebody has a car accident and they get very badly burned, they may have plastic surgery to reconstruct their face. And although this is aesthetic surgery, it's plastic surgery, technically speaking, it's not like getting a boob job. It's considered to be medically necessary. And it would be perfectly understandable and normal for a doctor to approve a patient to get a face transplant, even though that patient is severely depressed. You're not going to say that person is depressed, they're not mentally well, we don't think that they're capable of understanding, and therefore we're going to deny them the face transplant, because it is understandable that a person who has lost their face in a car accident is going to feel pretty cut up about it and may be depressed because they can't look at people, they look ugly, and giving them a face transplant, we know that these sorts of procedures do improve mental health. Or the same thing with a cleft palate operation on babies. You might say that is technically plastic surgery, but we definitely don't say, oh, babies don't have capacity, they can't have that kind of plastic surgery. It's viewed as being medically necessary. Now, what's happened here is that WPATH managed to persuade people to view the body of a person with gender dysphoria as if that person has been in a car accident, has been burned, and they need reparative surgery to fix a deformity. So the breasts of a gender dysphoric teenage girl become akin to cancer that requires removal. And this approach was then carried into the official policies of the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics. And even here, you can find this sort of thing in the language in the NHS. And in fact, the American Medical Association has statements on its website that it considers this to be necessary care, and they consider it to include procedures that they deem to be evidence-based. And when they're talking about evidence-based procedures, what they mean is procedures that fall within WPATH standards of care, which of course we now know to be pseudoscience. Now, when you have a medically necessary treatment, two things happen. One is that you start to be able to argue that you can get someone to pay for it, the national health system in the UK or your health insurance in the States. As opposed to the way it was originally for people, the earliest patients who had gender distress, where they had to pay for it out of pocket in the same way as people do when they get a boob job. So whereas previously the only people who were getting these treatments were grown adults, typically middle-aged men with a lot of money who could afford to do it and obviously had to think about it for a long time in order to spend that much money. Now you're getting all sorts of other people, for example, homeless people, people who are really mentally unwell, who would have no capacity to pay for these things, and they're getting it paid for by their health insurance or by socialized healthcare. Right, so the first thing is that making it necessary means money. The second is it affects consent because necessary healthcare, you don't need the same level of competence in order to consent. Somebody could always consent on your behalf. And I think this is why, you know, people wonder what on earth is going on with these insane evil doctors manipulating the meaning of capacity in order to suggest that a nonverbal autistic child could agree to be given drugs that will sterilize them or prevent them from developing, or that you give somebody with dissociative identity disorder or testosterone. What's going on inside the heads of these doctors? Well, what's going on inside their heads is, and I've seen this argument made by friends of mine who are left wing, that nobody would argue that somebody who's mentally ill will be denied an appendectomy. So if you're not going to deny somebody who's mentally ill an appendectomy, how can you deny this person who is mentally ill this necessary health care? And you're discriminating against this person who is trans by not giving them their necessary health care, whereas other people will be able to have their necessary health care. And that's because you've reclassified a treatment that was previously viewed as aesthetic surgery, and now you're viewing it as being medically necessary. It's a bit like saying trans women are women. Trans health care is health care. You're treating a person's body, which is the natural body of that person, as if it's not natural. As if you've been in an accident and you've got a scarred face that needs treatment. You're treating the discomfort of a gender dysphoric person as if it's caused by their body being faulty and it needs fixing. And the minute you view this condition as needing necessary treatment, you're putting it in the category of treatment for which a paternalistic person could decide on behalf of another person who lacks capacity that they should have that treatment because you know what's best for them. And that's what's going on with these gender doctors. And they have these children come in and they decide the children should have to go on puberty blockers when it's obvious they don't have capacity. And I think everybody here, the doctors know these children lack capacity. In fact, the parents are having to give consent on behalf of the child. And this is a child who couldn't even get a tattoo. But because you hold this metaphysical belief that this child has an innate gender and they were born in the wrong body, and therefore their body is broken, it needs fixing, and therefore this treatment that you're offering is not just some vanity thing like getting a boob job, it's necessary medical care. And how can you deny this person necessary medical care just because the child's autistic or the child is mentally ill? Why would you deny that? You as a paternalistic physician are going to have to decide on behalf of the patient what's in their best interest. But of course, we also see that the doctors in WPATH, now they know that the actual evidence for this being evidence-based care isn't there. So what they also do is they flip it the other way, and they also argue it's informed consent because they know about the weaknesses in the evidence. I think what happened here is at a certain point, they made the argument that this was medically necessary, and they had to, because otherwise they couldn't get the payments and they couldn't rationalize doing the stuff to kids who don't have capacity. And then people started asking questions, and they asked, where is the evidence this is medically necessary? And of course, I've looked for the evidence, and a few years ago, I thought this sort of thing had evidence. And the more I looked, the more I realized that the whole thing is so incredibly shoddy. And they couldn't find the evidence because there aren't any controlled trials. It's all based on this belief system to do with gender identity, and that if your gender identity doesn't match your body, then you need to transition as if your body has been mutilated or something like that. It's a statement based on faith. So now we've got this pushback against the idea that you even need to have evidence. And so you get people talking a lot in terms of bodily autonomy, embodiment goals, and that you shouldn't need to justify, and you don't even need a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. You have to be allowed to do what you want. So simultaneously, you get these two things happening. This is what happens when you queer consent. Simultaneously, you view these treatments as being medically necessary in order to get the payment from the insurance, in order that you can rationalize projecting your beliefs on what's best for a patient onto them when they don't have capacity. And at the same time, you've got this whole narrative denying that there is any such thing as gender dysphoria, and there's no illness at all here. This is not a mental illness. Why do they do this? And the answer is that there are two different things going on at once here. So firstly, you've got the adults. A lot of adults who have desires to have their bodies altered in all sorts of ways that are often quite bizarre. So, for example, you get people who want to be eunuchs or want to have both kinds of genitalia because they identify as being non-binary. Just really bizarre stuff. And also a lot of people with really severe mental health problems pushing to get their treatments and their surgeries. And what they want to do is to get rid of any stigma of mental illness on this, because mental health problems mean you're not allowed to get aesthetic surgeries like plastic surgery, facial surgery, and so much of the details of the treatments that adults will be getting, it's very hard to argue that they aren't aesthetic. For example, facial surgery. And these, of course, are adults. So it's not like there's somebody else who's going to decide on their behalf what's in their best interests. And this is where the pushes come against the gender dysphoria diagnosis. And rather that you should view this as an expression of an identity, that a person who doesn't have cis privilege and therefore has a body which is inconsistent with their identity has a right to health care to bring that body in line with their identity. And therefore the medical care should get paid for. And it's a social justice thing that should be paid for. And you'll often hear this language of equity, this language of social justice. Cis people are privileged to be born with the right kind of body. How dare a cis person decide a trans person can't have that same right to an aligned body? But unless you have capacity to decide what body you should have, you can't consent to plastic surgery. So you have to deny that there's any disorder at all of gender dysphoria. And you have to simply make the argument that the body being misaligned with your identity is itself a physical disorder that needs treatment. So that's what's going on with the adults. Now, separately from that, you have what's going on with the children. And that is that you have doctors, in many cases parents, or parents being gaslighted by doctors. And they're convinced that child's behavior and their statements mean that they're trans, which means that they have a gender identity which is not aligned with their body, which means their body is wrong, which means that they're like somebody who's been maimed in an accident, which means that this is a necessary medical procedure. And when someone has a necessary medical procedure, you don't need the same degree of consent, and you can coax consent out of the patient. And of course, the thing to understand is that when they talk about consent with respect to these kids or these people who are mentally unwell, they're not talking about consent in the sense that you would normally understand it. For example, if somebody is deciding to go and get a boob job or some other kind of plastic surgery, we're talking about consent in the way that you would get consent from somebody who's about to have an appendectomy, but who is lacking in capacity, in that you want to help them understand why it's necessary and help them to say yes, because you know what's right for them. You're being paternalistic. So here's how you can understand this in terms of queer theory. The queering of consent. How does it work? Well, we have two ideas of consent here. One is the civil libertarian idea of consent, which is that a person has a right to do what they want with their body. And of course, that's for a person who has capacity. And then you have the idea it's discriminatory to view some people as having capacity when other people don't. And that means that this civil liberty idea of capacity needs to be applied to a broader and broader group of people. And if you claim that someone doesn't have capacity, you're engaging in discrimination. You are prejudiced. You're bigoted against people who are mentally ill. That's what's going on here. So you have this idea of a medically necessary procedure. And when a procedure is medically necessary, then as a physician or as a parent, you have a right to actually give consent on behalf of somebody else who doesn't have capacity. You can be paternalistic. So you take transmedicalization, which doesn't fit any reasonable stretch of the imagination within the category of necessary medical procedures, which are evidence-based. But in spite of the fact that the facts don't show that it should be within this category, you assert, the same way you assert trans women are women, you assert gender-affirming healthcare is healthcare. In fact, I think that that's one of the mantras. Gender-affirming care is healthcare. Trans healthcare is healthcare. It's an assertion. And if you say gender-affirming care is not healthcare, you're saying you're implying that trans people are not as human as other people and that their medical needs are not as important. Trans healthcare is a corollary of the idea that trans people are people. If you believe that trans people are people, then their healthcare is healthcare. But of course, when you say trans people's healthcare is healthcare, when you accept that statement as being true, you're accepting it as being true because you're identifying the word healthcare with what we normally think of healthcare. Like things like your appendix out, the same way as when you talk about women being weak and needing to be kept away from men in prison, you're thinking of women in the normal sense of the word. But now this word healthcare, no, is now being applied to transmedicalization, which is not the thing you were thinking of when you agreed to the statement that trans healthcare is healthcare. But suddenly now this new quote unquote healthcare, which isn't healthcare, which is like something which could be sold by a snake oil salesman, which isn't proven, it's not tested in the same way, which is not subject to scrutiny the way other healthcare is subject to scrutiny, this so-called healthcare gets categorized as healthcare. And you're not allowed to question whether this healthcare is healthcare, like other healthcare, because if you do that, you're denying transhuman rights, because you're saying that trans people don't have a right to healthcare, like other people have a right to healthcare. So if a trans person gets denied their healthcare, they'll go to court and they'll sue and they'll say this is not indirect discrimination against them because other people get their healthcare, but these people don't get their healthcare, besides the fact that we're not talking about the same thing when we say the word healthcare. So there's slippage here, and you end up with a situation where this thing that isn't healthcare is now called healthcare, just like trans women who are not women get called women. It's exactly the same thing. So healthcare, being healthcare, now has to get paid for by your health insurance. You can't discriminate against trans people by having their healthcare not get paid for. And also because necessary healthcare, you can loosen up on the requirements for consent by being allowed to be paternalistic and decide on behalf of a vulnerable patient, like somebody who's mentally ill or a child, that you know is in their best interest because you understand that this patient is trans. You're the expert, you're the doctor, you can see inside their soul. So paternalistically, you can then approve of the child having healthcare done to them that they would not have the capacity to consent for, which they actually have not consented to, and you've consented on their behalf. And you do it in the name of personal autonomy and human rights and equality. Now, when they do this, they're actually doing two things at once. Firstly, if you question whether a person can really give consent to these procedures, then they'll come back and make the argument about the appendectomy or diabetes and how you wouldn't deny a person instant or an appendectomy because they're autistic or have DID and it's discriminatory. You do the paternalistic thing. But now the other side is, what if you now question whether this healthcare is in fact medically sound and whether there's actually evidence for that? Then they'll flip the argument and they'll argue back and they'll say, how can you dare to be so paternalistic and decide for these people what they should want? Gender dysphoria is not an illness, and there's nothing wrong with people with gender dysphoria. They're entitled to make their own choices about their own bodies. So they make the one argument when they need to get payment from the health system or to extract consent from children. And they make the other argument when people challenge them on the evidence. And they do both simultaneously. And it's actually very similar to where the people queer the concept of a woman in order to gaslight women about single-sex spaces. So just as an analogy, if you take the discussion about whether a trans woman should have access to single-sex spaces, whether trans women should be in women's prisons, they're going to make the argument from women's fragility and women being vulnerable, therefore trans women being vulnerable because they're women, they need to be protected from men. And therefore trans women should be in women's prisons because they mustn't be in men's prisons. They might get attacked or raped or whatever. But then when you argue back and say, hold a minute, this trans woman is a physical male. It could even be a rapist. And women don't feel safe sharing space with this person, then they'll say, hold a minute, don't engage in sex stereotypes. Women aren't so weak. Who's saying women are so weak? And they do both things at once, and they flip it one way or the other. Have you ever had these conversations with people? I've had these conversations myself with left-wing friends. They don't even realize that they're doing it. And this is exactly what queer theory does. It's what happens when you queer a concept, you hold two different meanings in your head at one at the same time, and you use one meaning or the other meaning depending on which one you need for your argument. And I know people who do this. I've seen people do it. I've seen my friends do it. People who are not intellectually trained, maybe don't have the mathematics background that I have, they'll fall into this trap very, very easily because you have to be very, very alert to realize that it's happening. It doesn't mean that the people doing this are evil. It just means that they've got sloppy brains that haven't been well trained in thinking clearly. Okay, so moving forward. If we can escape this trap of queer theory and fuzzy language, what can we actually say here that's clear? So just to summarize, I would say that there are three different categories of healthcare. Number one, you have medically necessary care. In that case, the care can be given to people even if they lack capacity. Somebody who knows the best their best interests will paternalistically consent on their behalf. And sometimes parents can even be coerced into giving their child health care that's necessary. For example, there have been these court cases with Christian Scientists, or even you often get parents being coerced into having health care for their children because a court decides it's medically necessary. And you also don't have the same need for informed consent. So if, for example, somebody is suicidal, you can treat them against their will because your treatment is medically necessary. That's category one, medically necessary. Category two are optional aesthetic procedures such as boob jobs, butt lifts, nose jobs. And in that case, only somebody who has capacity is able to consent to those. And there is a much stricter gatekeeping, more severe regulation on advertising, etc., to protect people from being preyed upon by unscrupulous doctors. And then category three are the procedures that we as a society don't let people have at all because we know these things are clearly harmful. There's a limit to our libertarianism. So, for example, there was a guy in the UK. I've put a link in the show notes to an article about it. He was prosecuted for doing extreme body modifications on extremely satisfied clients. As far as I can see, not a single client complained, but he was still convicted and prosecuted. And we consider that anybody who wants to have their arm cut off must lack capacity. Their desire is unreasonable. No, the whole debate over the treatment of gender distress is about what category this sort of healthcare falls into. So WPATH classifies gender care into category one, necessary healthcare. And they do this without real evidence. I mean, basically, you assert that it's medically necessary, and then you go do the research afterwards to try to garner evidence, a bit like an intelligent design research as an alternative to evolution. It's the same kind of attitude. First, we decide it's necessary. Then we look for the evidence. Oh, the evidence isn't quite there yet. Just wait. We'll get the evidence later. We'll do the surgery first. Then we'll get the evidence. But unfortunately, we have the American Medical Association and all sorts of other health systems around the world going along with this. Then there is the position of many, many liberals I know, even some liberals who are quite critical of for example, trans medicalization of children. And they make the argument that if people want to transition, it's their life, we shouldn't stop them. But of course, not children, because children can give a consent. And so gender medicine gets put in this category too. Note that with this category, you wouldn't be able to ask health insurance to pay for it. But with category one allows you to get medical insurance to pay for it. And that's one of the main reasons why WPATH argues for putting gender healthcare in category one of necessary healthcare. Now, there's a third category of healthcare which isn't healthcare, which should never be done to anyone because it's just harm. Many critics of the gender industry, some of the more extreme gender criticals, will view all gender healthcare as being in category three. And people will argue that anybody who wants to have their penis inverted or have their healthy breasts amputated must be crazy. And they should be treated the same way as somebody who wants to have a leg amputated due to body dysmorphia. Now, the consequences of WPATH putting healthcare in category one are as follows. When we queer the concept of evidence-based necessary healthcare, when we insist that trans healthcare is healthcare, we get a number of very, very serious consequences. Firstly, we get reduced ethical standards for this care because it's not treated as aesthetic healthcare has a higher ethical standard. Secondly, we have looser regulations on things like advertising. So you get these gender clinics with their stories on their web pages and pictures of happy girls with their breasts off. You wouldn't get that sort of thing normally. Most countries have regulations on advertising to prevent that, but because it's considered to be necessary healthcare, they can do that. And thirdly, you get this ability to give consent on behalf of those who lack capacity, and therefore you are allowed to medicalize children. And in fact, you even get cases of parents losing custody of their children because they wouldn't medicalize them, because that's deemed to be neglect of their children, as if they had refused to give their child an appendectomy. Now, I know that many liberals, including many liberals who are gender critical, will gravitate towards position two. And I just want to highlight that there's a trap here of bodily autonomy. I don't know the way out, but there's a trap here. See, ideally, in a free society, we'd like as much as possible to view body modification procedures as being a matter of choice. I'm a liberal. I think people should be basically allowed to live the life that they want to live. But we have a problem here. And the problem is this. You've got these doctors, and what they tell patients puts pressure on them. And that makes informed consent impossible. The incorrect advice itself constitutes an external pressure. When you're told that this healthcare falls into category one, when the doctor says this is necessary, it's very difficult to say no. And so the existence of the dishonesty and the over-exaggerated claims about the efficacy of treatments takes healthcare that would otherwise be in category two and it moves it into category three. And I've heard so many stories about people who will even be on the trolley going into these surgeries and they're having second thoughts. And they express those second thoughts to the nurse. And the nurse says, don't worry, don't worry. Lots of people get nervous. This surgery, you need it. You need this. You'll feel better afterwards. And then how they didn't feel better afterwards. I've heard that particular story so many times from detransitioners. And it's because of the dishonesty of the doctor telling you this is necessary healthcare when really it isn't, as opposed to somebody who's been dying to have this done for years and that's what they really, really know they want. And then it's like somebody getting a boob job. And that's much less likely to, well, we get regret, but it's, there isn't the same kind of risk because you're not being lied to by the doctor. We've also all heard about parents who acquiesce to putting their children on puberty blockers because a doctor says, do you want a live son or a dead daughter? But this happens to adults too. The gaslighting is not confined to the parents of children. And just in conclusion, my worry about all this discussion of the WPATH files is that a lot of the discussion is missing the point. We're focusing too much on the fact that children don't have capacity to consent. And when you focus on this alone, you're still treating gender care as if there is informed consent for those who have capacity. And I really question whether at the moment, with all the misinformation flying about, because the doctors doing these procedures are part of a quasi-religious cult, so their judgment can't be trusted, I don't know if informed consent is even possible here. So how do we move forward? Well, I have a few thoughts. My first thought is that in an ideal world, given the rampant malpractice that's going on, I really feel there should be a moratorium on all new medicalizations, even of adults, until the profession has its house in order, because it's just such a mess. But we can't have what happened in Texas, one of the clinics that shut suddenly there, afterwards exposed that they were engaged in really unethical procedures. They just closed. They just shut. And so patients, many of whom had their genitals removed, or they lost their gonads, so they had no natural hormones, they were just basically told, bye. And the point is that people who've already had procedures done, had their bodies altered, they need follow-up care. They need hormone replacement therapy. We all need sex hormones. If you've lost your testicles, you need either testosterone or estrogen. If you get neither, you get sick. So I really hope that over time, we can come to some sort of sensible outcome, maybe return things back to the way they were maybe 20 years ago, where only people who had really, really severe distress that's been going on for years and know what they're doing can get anything done to them. But I can't see how we can ever again deem any of this kind of healthcare to be medically necessary. It's just too dangerous because I don't see how you could do the studies in order to distinguish which patients should and which patients shouldn't. And we know that the consequences of viewing trans healthcare as being medically necessary have been incredibly dangerous, and we just cannot have that happen again. Thank you for listening to Heterodox Jewish Women. If you look in the show notes, you can find links to a variety of sources mentioned in the recording. And also you can find a link to my Substack where you can find all of my other materials and articles.